lots where he could eventually build some individual rental houses himself. Chip and his father made good money on that sale, and that allowed us to do some more investing, hire more help, and get started building some more little rental houses, basically sinking every penny that came into our long-term future. In our personal lives, we were still barely scraping by, but the business side of things was going well. In fact, we were seeing so much growth and progress on 3rd Street that there were times when we felt as if the whole neighborhood was ours. Only it wasn't.
By this time, we had 3 dogs, Shiner, Maggie, and Blue, all rescue mutts. It was too crowded in an 800-square-foot house to have the dogs inside at all times, so we'd let those dogs out to roam around a bit. They were a lot like me and pretty much thought they owned the entire 3rd Street. I had this four-wheeler that I'd ride up and down the street with, just checking on everything, and those dogs would run right alongside me. They were some of the best dogs you've ever seen. They never bothered anyone, certainly never bit anyone, or even really came close. But we had this one neighbor across the street who just hated those dogs, and every single time she saw them off a leash, which was just about all the time, she would call the animal control. The people from the pound would show up, haul the dogs downtown in their van, and write us these tickets to in either Joe or I's name. There were times when the officer would literally call the dog right off the front porch, "Come here, dogs!" And they'd hop in the van, off they'd go, back for another stay at the pound. These were not like parking tickets either. They came with a heavy fine, which I absolutely refused to pay out of some kind of misguided principle. I never was much of a rule follower, and this "put your dog on a leash" rule was no exception. If the dogs had been hurting somebody, I'd have certainly understood that. But to take them from my own front yard? Well, guess what? When you don't pay your fines, eventually the police come looking for you.
We owed something like $2,500 in tickets, and we simply didn't have that kind of money lying around, even if we wanted to pay the fines, especially since I was about to have a baby. Sure enough, 2 weeks early, I delivered a beautiful, healthy baby boy that we named Drake. We named him after the New York hotel where we'd stayed on our honeymoon. So Drake was a week old and I was sitting in this house, feeding him in the back room, when I heard a knock on the door. Chip answered it. It was the police. "Is Joanna Gaines here? We have a warrant here for her arrest," the officer said. It was the tickets. I knew it, and I panicked. I picked up my son and I hid in the closet. I literally didn't know what to do. I'd never even had a speeding ticket, and all of a sudden I'm thinking, I'm about to go to prison, and my child won't be able to eat. What is this kid gonna do? I heard Chip say, "She's not here, sir." Thankfully, Drake didn't make a peep, and the officer believed him. He said, "Well, just let her know we're looking for her," and they left.
Jo is the most conservative girl in the world. She's never even been late for school. I mean, this girl was straight-laced. So now we realize this citywide warrant is out for her arrest, and we're like, oh, crap. In her defense, Joe had wanted to pay the tickets all along, and I was the one saying, "No way, I'm not paying these tickets." So we decided to try to make it right. We called the judge, and the court clerk told us, "Okay, you've got an appointment at 3 p.m. to discuss these tickets. See you then." We wanted to ask the judge if he could remove a few of them for us. The fines for these dogs running at large on our front porch just seemed to be really excessive.
We arrived at the courthouse, and Chip was carrying Drake in his car seat. I couldn't carry it because I was still recovering from Drake's delivery. We got inside and spoke to a clerk. They looked at the circumstances and decided to switch all the tickets into Chip's name.
Those dogs were basically mine, and it didn't make much sense to have the tickets in her name. But as soon as they did that, the police officer walked over and said, "Do you mind emptying all of your pockets?" I got up and cooperated. Absolutely, yes, I said. I figured it was just procedure before we went to see the judge. Then he said, you mind taking off that belt?" I thought, well, that's weird. Then he said, "Do you mind turning around and putting your hands behind your back?"
They weren't going to let us talk to the judge at all. The whole thing was just a sting to get us to come down there and be arrested. They arrested Chip on the spot, and I'm sitting there saying, "I can't carry this baby in his car seat. What am I supposed to do?" I started bawling. "You can't take him," I cried. But they did. They took him right outside and put him in the back of a police car.
Now I feel like the biggest loser in the world. I'm in the back of a police car, and my crying wife comes out holding our one-week-old baby.
I'm walking out, limping, and waving to him as they drive away.
And I can't even wave because my hands are cuffed behind my back. So here I am awkwardly trying to wave with a motion with my shoulder and squinching my face just to try to make Joe feel a bit better.
It was just the most comical thing, honestly. A total joke. To take a man to jail because his dogs like to walk around a neighborhood, half of which he owns, but it sure wasn't funny at the time. I was flooded with hormones and just could not stop crying. They told me they were taking my husband to the county jail. Luckily, we had a buddy who was an attorney, so I called him. I was clueless. I'd never dated a guy that's been in trouble, and now I've got a husband that's in jail. What do I do? What's the first step here? I asked him. He made some calls, and he told me that I could get Chip out with a bail bond for $800. It couldn't be done with a personal check, and we didn't have $800 in the bank anyway. I needed $800 in cash to go buy a money order at the gas station near the facility in order to get Chip out of jail, and I didn't have the money to do it. My parents or his parents would have given us that money in a heartbeat, I'm sure, but I was too embarrassed. I didn't want our parents to know we didn't have $800 between us, and I certainly didn't want them knowing Chip was in the slammer. Thankfully, I had my shop. I went and emptied out both the cash register and the safe in the back. I didn't know how I'd make the change the next day, and I had no idea how we'd make up for that loss when it came time to pay the bills. But I had no choice. It was the only money I had. Off I went to the gas station, then I went to the jail with my week-old son strapped to my chest and his baby Bjorn, and I waited. And waited. Chip had been there for a few very long hours. I had all kinds of awful thoughts about what might have happened to him in there. What if he'd been roughed up, strip-searched? Who knows what awful things could have happened in a place like that? I saw scary-looking characters come and go as I sat in that cold, concrete lobby trying to make myself invisible. Finally, out came Chip. "Hi, baby. Thanks for bailing me out," he said. He sounded almost chipper. "Are you okay?" "Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. You'll never guess who I saw in there. Alfonso. Remember the long guy who used to work for me? We had a good time catching up." Only Chip could go to prison and come out talking about all the friends he'd run into there.
I came out and was like, "Whoa, that was awesome. Joe, I just met this guy who used to do this thing for me. You know that guy that I used to talk about? He and I used to work together. Man, he's doing great. Well, I mean, he's in jail, but other than that, he's doing really good." Two of the policemen were also buddies of mine. These guys were literally standing on the other side of these bars going, "Why are you here? What is the deal?" We had this endearing conversation right there while I was standing in this jail cell. I used to live out in the boonies when I was in college, and I had mowed this guy's grass for years. So I told him what I was in for. Long story short, I got these dogs running around, and he was like, "Oh, dude, you'll be fine. I'm sure you'll be out of here in no time."
It was just another day in my new life with Chip Gaines, but that was the moment I realized that we were right on the edge of a real financial struggle, and I didn't like that feeling. I have a naturally conservative nature, and Chip and I were supposed to balance each other out, not concede to each other's strengths and weaknesses. My strength is saving and being tight with the money, but I had not exercised that strength recently. I had let my head get in the clouds and forgotten that this was important. Not having the money to pay for those tickets in the first place should have been a wake-up call. Having to scrape the bottom of our barrel for bail money was certainly cause for alarm. I promised myself I would start putting money aside for future emergencies. I don't think it's irrational or too conservative of me to think, I never want to carry my baby into the county jail ever again. Is it? 7. One door closes. The very next week, I got back to work. I needed to get back in the shop and start making some sales to recoup the money we'd pulled out for bail and then to pay off the rest of those tickets. I didn't have a babysitter or the money to pay one, so I started working every day with a 2-week-old baby. We set up a little nursery area in the back office with a pack-and-play portable crib, and I worked the register with Drake and his baby Bjorn. I would run to the back of the office to feed him, and then, of course, a customer would walk in, so I'd have to wrap up the feeding session, which would make him cry. I knew I needed to get some help at the shop. I couldn't do all of this by myself anymore. Thank God for Jessica. She was a good friend from college, one of the 2 sets of twins in our wedding, and best of all, she was available. I hired her on to assist behind the register, and that gave me a little bit of freedom. Jessica had a way about her that made every customer feel warm and welcome. I was thankful for her diligence and friendship during that time when I was both a new mom and a new business owner. Just as Drake turned 6 weeks old, I decided I wanted to lose some baby weight. Chip and I were both still getting used to the idea that we had a baby of our own now, but I felt it was okay to leave him with Chip for half an hour or so in the morning so I could take a short run up and down 3rd Street. I left Drake in the little swing he loved, kissed Chip goodbye, and off I went. Chip was so sweet and supportive. When I got back, he was standing in the doorway saying, "Way to go, Jojo." He handed me a banana and asked if I had had any cramps or anything, and I hadn't. I actually felt great. I walked in and discovered Chip had prepared an elaborate breakfast for me, as if I had run a marathon or something. I hadn't done more than half a mile walk-run, but he wanted to celebrate the idea that I was trying to get myself back together physically. He'd actually driven to the store and back and bought fresh fruit and real maple syrup and orange juice for me. I sat down to eat, and I looked over at Drake. He was sound asleep in a swing, still wearing nothing but his diaper. Chip, did you take Drake to the grocery store without any clothes on? Chip gave me a real funny look, and he said, what? I gave him a funny look back. Oh, my goodness, he said. I totally forgot Drake was here. He was so quiet. Chip, I yelled, totally freaked out. I was a first-time mom. Can you imagine? Anyone who's met Chip knows he can get a little sidetracked, but this was our child.
He was in that dang swing that made him perfectly silent. I felt terrible. It had only been a few minutes, and you know the store was just down the street, but I literally got on my knees and begged Joe's forgiveness.
Several days later, I decided to go on a good long jog, trusting that Chip would not leave Drake again. As I was on my way back, I saw Chip coming down the road in his truck with a trailer on it. He rolled up to me with his window down and said, hey, Joe, you're doing so good. I'm heading to work now. I've got to go. I looked in the back thinking, of course he's got Drake, but I didn't see a car seat.
Chip, where's Drake? She said. And I was like, oh, shoot. She took off without a word and ran like lightning all the way back to the house as I turned the truck around. She literally got there faster on foot than I did in my truck. I sure hope no one from Child Protective Services listens to this book. They can't come after me retroactively, can they?
Chip promised it would never happen again. So the third time I attempted to take a run, I went running down 3rd Street and made it all the way home. I walked in, and Chip and Drake were gone. I thought, oh, good. Finally, he remembered to take the baby. But then I noticed his car was still parked out front. I looked around. I couldn't find him anywhere. Moments later, Chip pulled up on his four-wheeler with Drake bungee strapped to the handlebars in his car seat. Chip, I screamed, what in the heck are you doing? Oh, he was crying, and I'd always heard my mom say she would drive me around the neighborhood when I was a baby, and it made me feel better, Chip said. He loved it. He fell right asleep. He didn't love it, Chip. He probably fell asleep because the wind in his face made it impossible to breathe. I didn't go for another run for the whole first year of Drake's life, and I took him to the shop with me every single day. Some people might see that as a burden, but I have to admit, I loved it. Having him in that baby Bjorn was the best feeling in the world. Drake was a shop baby. He would come home every night smelling like candles.
We had these friends who owned this barbecue joint, and their baby always came home smelling like a rack of ribs. You know, I like Drake's smell a whole lot better.
A lot of my clientele seemed to have kids who were older, and I swear every single one of those moms would smile and coo over Drake, saying, Joanna, this goes by so fast. You need to embrace these moments. My kids are getting ready to go off to college, and it feels just like yesterday they were little like this. And as much as they loved shopping at my store, some of my best customers kept saying, yeah, you should think about taking some time off. Maybe close up the shop for a while, because this is a moment in time you'll never get back. Don't work too much. Just make sure you're all in with your baby. I didn't listen at first. What new mom does? It seems as if every day lasts forever when you're up all night with feedings and changing smelly diapers. But the more I heard those words, the more they started to sink in. Toward the end of 2005, Chip came across an opportunity to buy a nice lot just up the road from where we lived. He knew how cramped we were in that little white house, and even though he'd felt as though any money we made should be reinvested in the business and rolled into the next project, he asked me one day if maybe we should invest in building a house of our own. Yes, I said. I really love the idea. Chip was pretty certain he could get the financing together for the house if we bought the land, but the parcel of land was $5,000, and he wasn't sure how we were going to get it before somebody else snatched it up. That's when I surprised him. Ever since the jail incident, I had been saving a little money here and there from my sales at the shop. I just set it away where neither of us would touch it until there was something important to use it on, just for us. The amount of money I'd saved was exactly $5,000, just what we needed to buy that land. So we went for it, and together we designed a comfortable 1,600-square-foot home from the ground up. I loved designing this home from the beginning stages. I learned that unlike the older homes we had renovated, a new home doesn't come with oak floors, thick trim, and built-in character. And I learned pretty quickly that adding character was expensive. If I wanted our place to be special and unique, I had to get creative. On the exterior, for instance, we wanted rock, but only could afford enough for the front of the house. So we added larger trees in the landscape to hide the side elevation and draw attention to the front door. Speaking of that front door, Chip had to get creative himself. Buying things for clients was one thing, but buying stuff for our house was a different story. We had this charming arch door crafted out of solid mesquite wood that Chip had bought from a guy whose shop was going out of business. The best thing about this door was it had a little peep door at the top that you could open so you could see who was on the other side. It felt very Hansel and Gretel. This amazing door brought the perfect balance to this heavy rock exterior, and it made it feel like a quaint, rustic cottage. On the inside, we couldn't afford the oak wood floors I loved, so we opted for stained concrete. I didn't want the room to look too cold, so we ended up scoring the concrete in a large diagonal pattern that made the floors look like $1 million. We had some exterior rock left over, so I decided to mount the remaining pieces as a chair rail under our bar top, which Chip had constructed from reclaimed wood. Eventually, it all came together, and we thought it was beautiful. It was so rewarding to stay on budget, but have a house that was unique in its own special way. In 2006, we moved in, and the layout worked so well that we decided our own house would make the perfect model for a new set of student rental homes. We figured we could fit 8 of those houses along the frontage parcels that Chip had retained after selling part of the 11 acres to that big out-of-town development company. But building those houses would mean getting a bigger line of credit and expanding Chip's ragtag home building and house flipping business into more of a bona fide company. This house-building business quickly became more than Chip's company. It became our company, a true fusion of what he was doing and what I was doing. We decided to call it Magnolia Homes. It was right around that time when I found out I was pregnant with our second child. This time it was going to be a girl, and we decided to name her Ella Rose. Sales at my shop were better in my second year than they'd been in the first. I was building a reputation and had a steady client base, and I felt like I was starting to actually know what I was talking about in terms of design. I love that shop, and I love being there every day. Yet once I was pregnant with Ella, I heard a voice. Remember the voice on our first date, the one that told me that Chip was the man I would marry? This was the same voice, but this time it was saying, "Joe, it's time to stay home with your babies." I didn't really want to hear that. In fact, I argued with the voice, just as I had argued about what it had said about Chip. "No, I can't," I said. "I'm finally getting this. It's working." And it was working, better than I ever expected. That shop meant something to a lot of people, and I'm not just talking about me and my clientele. It seemed that wherever we went and whatever we did, Chip would always find some kids to mentor along the way. One late night, we were at the shop unboxing some candles that had just come in, and Chip noticed 2 young boys walking through our parking lot. They were all of 10 years old. "Hey, boys," he said, "it's late. What are you guys doing out here on the streets this time of night?" They said they lived in the neighborhood behind the shop, and they always walked around at night. So Chip said, "Hey, you want to make a little bit of money?" Of course the boys said yes. He invited them to come help us with inventory and gave them work, sweeping and doing some other chores for a few bucks an hour. We always seemed to find ourselves at the shop doing something late at night, so those boys started dropping by regularly. "Hey, Chip and JoJo," they'd say, "got any work for us?" Being able to mentor those kids just added to the value of being at that shop. I love that. It was such a good feeling to see those kids fired up about doing some work rather than wandering around after dark where trouble was sure to find them. What I'm trying to say is that I truly loved everything about that shop. But the voice just kept on telling me, "Joe, it's time." I wrestled with it for weeks until I finally felt it in my heart. I thought about the words of all those women who were in my shop every day, telling me to cherish the time with my child. Soon I would have 2 children whose time deserved cherishing. As much as I didn't want it to be true, I could no longer deny that the voice was right. I'm the type of person who can wrestle with something for a long time, but when I finally make up my mind, I'm all in. This was one of those times. I was lying in bed with Chip one night, and I spoke it out loud. I didn't pose it as a question. It wasn't something I needed advice on. I was resolved. "Chip, we're shutting the shop down." Chip was curious as to why I'd come to this decision, of course, and I told him confidently, "God told me to do it." How could he argue with that? In March of 2006, we sold off everything, the inventory, the displays, even the cash register. And it was hard. That shop was my dream, a dream that had landed on my yellow steno pad after I came home from my eye-opening internship in New York City. It was the first dream of mine that I'd seen come to fruition, and in many ways it was like our first baby. Chip and I had remodeled that old shop with our bare hands. We'd laughed about how many nails had been driven into those old floorboards. There were thousands of them. And thought about the guy who had put in so much time and effort all those years ago just to make sure those floors were as solid as could be. We were proud of everything we'd done to accentuate the work of those who came before us and to turn that quirky little building into a shop that exceeded the dreams I'd drawn out on paper a few years earlier. But the shop was more to me than just an accomplishment or even the fulfillment of a dream. It was something Chip and I had dreamed and accomplished together, from scratch. It wasn't his business that I added to or my business that he added to. It was ours. At some point every day, no matter what he had going on at the various job sites, Chip had been there with me, sitting in that little back office at the desk right next to the pack and play, doing his thing while I was doing mine. I will remember till the day I die the moment I stood on the front steps and locked the shop door for the last time as tears rolled down my face. Even as I stood on those steps trying to say goodbye, I kept asking God, "Are you sure this is the right move? If it is, why does it seem so painful and hard?" That's when I heard that gentle whisper, "Joanna, if you trust me with your dreams, I'll take them further than you could have ever imagined." It's no easy thing to trust in God and to walk away from a career, to give it all up, not knowing if you can ever get it back or even come close. But I did. I heeded his voice, and somehow I found peace about it. We put the shop on the market and hoped to find a buyer for that property as soon as possible. Obviously, we wanted to respect it the way Maybelle had respected it when she sold it to us. We still love Maybelle, who had become like a grandmother to us. We used to visit her in the nursing home where she lived and be her guest when they had pancake suppers. But we just couldn't afford to hold on to that building out of principle, the way she had. We both would have loved for someone to have saved that old building we'd worked so hard to fix up, but there just wasn't another Chip and Joanna out there who were looking for a property like that one. We couldn't keep paying a mortgage on a shop that wasn't open, so we told ourselves, it is what it is, we need to move on, we'll just see what happens. If someone came along and made us a decent offer, we would just have to cross that bridge when we came to it. We considered offers from some other developers and business owners and kept trying to make a deal, but for some reason, those deals kept falling through.
What's really interesting to me is just as Joe closed on the shop, Magnolia Homes was really starting to rock and roll. At the very same moment we were trying to sell that building, we were also looking for some office space for the company. We also needed a place where we could hire a secretary to do the books, but we were also looking for a spot where we had a little outdoor space where we could store our supplies and our materials, and possibly have a staging area, you know, for the boys to gather what they needed before they went to any particular job that day. I was out driving around with a buddy of mine who had helped me look for a location, and he'd actually found a couple of really cool spots around town, but we never found the spot that really jumped out at me. We happened to turn down Bosky as we were driving, and he asked, "What's the deal with the shop? Have you sold it yet?" I told him we had hit a few snags and hadn't been able to close on a deal yet, and right as we were driving past it, he said, "Well, have you ever thought about using that as your office?" It was like this giant light bulb went off over my head. I swung the truck around and pulled into the parking lot. I looked at the building with a whole new set of eyes. It had this parking lot in the front, but there was also this area in the back that was plenty big enough for storage unit that could hold all the lumber and the materials we kept on hand, anything else we might need to store. It had an office inside that was ready to go. And why couldn't we turn the front part, where the retail shop had been, into more office space too? The mortgage we were paying on that little building was less than the rent I'd be paying anywhere else by a good margin. "Dude, you're a genius," I said. The very next day, we jumped in and started renovating that store into the Magnolia Homes headquarters, adding the office and storage space that would make it home for our construction company.
Funny that we needed an outsider to bring that to our attention. We'd always seen that building as our shop, but now it was our headquarters, and we were going to get to hold on to that precious building. We could even keep our Magnolia sign. It felt right. The whole thing felt right. Being at home as a full-time mom meant giving up the shop, but it didn't mean giving up on everything else. Chip and I started working more closely together than ever. My design ideas were the backbone of Magnolia Homes, and I'd wind up coming in and out of that construction office as often as Chip had been in and out of that back office when it was my store. In the coming months, I'd actually figured out a way to stay in touch with all of my clientele and my wholesalers, and to continue Magnolia as a home furnishings brand without having a physical shop, too. I felt good about having made the decision to walk away and lock the door. It's funny, though, looking back on it now, because one very simple concept in life never occurred to me as I was walking away. Even locked doors can be unlocked in time. I simply never could have imagined just how much God had in store for us, and I certainly couldn't have dreamed just how many keys to other doors God had already placed in our hands. 8. Down to our roots. For the next 4 years, Chip and I were dedicated to one thing, raising our beautiful babies. In addition to Drake and Ella Rose, who was born in October of 2006, our family would come to include two more children, Duke and Emmy, who were born in 2008 and 2010, respectively. But when talking about our babies, we also mean our business. The reach of Magnolia Homes quickly expanded beyond our little neighborhood on 3rd Street and into other areas all over Waco. We had the opportunity to do all sorts of remodeling and renovation projects in a wide variety of homes, including some beautiful old homes in a historic part of town called Castle Heights. We did work there for some of the people who had frequented my now-closed shop, the wives of doctors and lawyers. And then, when they saw what we were capable of doing, those folks spread the word to neighbors and friends who had money to invest in more expensive remodeling projects. This wasn't just changing throw pillows and paint colors. We put Chip's growing expertise to work and added the capability and muscle the boys brought to the table to start tearing down walls, installing French doors, and creating new entryways, all catered to our clients' taste through the filter of my own evolving design aesthetic. Driving through the Castle Heights neighborhood, I was immediately drawn to it. I think almost anyone would be. It was full of beautiful, stately old homes with well-kept lawns, mostly tucked back off the main roads where there wasn't much traffic, so kids could play and ride bikes in the streets. And it wasn't a snobby sort of place either. Neighbors seemed to know each other, and their kids played together regularly. It seemed out of reach for us, and yet once we started working in those homes, I quickly started to dream about living in that neighborhood. Someday, I said to Chip. And well, you already know how my some days worked out when I spoke them out loud to Chip, but I'll share a little more about that in a bit. Looking back on those years, the thing that strikes me is that it all seemed to happen so fast. Maybe it was just a lack of sleep from having 4 kids in quick succession, but those years just seemed to blur together for me. I suppose a lot of young couples feel that way once kids come into the picture. Time does fly, just as those other moms had told me. Every time I turned around, it seemed as though Drake had suddenly grown another inch, or Ella Rose had started walking, or Duke and Emmy were sleeping through the night. These huge milestones came one on top of the other, and I felt truly blessed to be able to work from home, so I never missed a one, not to mention getting to work alongside my husband as we grew our business together. The magic that Chip and I had discovered early on, that we seemed to grow stronger the more we spent time together, never seemed to wear off. We were well past the honeymoon stage in our marriage, and yet we seemed to fall even more in love with each other now that we had children. We both fell in love with our work, too, with every new project we tackled as a team. Don't get me wrong, juggling that sort of entrepreneurial career with 4 little kids was not easy. It seemed that no matter how hard we worked, no matter how many extra jobs we picked up, we were still barely scraping by and living with huge amounts of debt. Chip never stopped pulling those crazy stunts, and each time I'd get just as angry over them as I'd gotten when he left Drake home alone those 2 times in his first few months. But we always worked things out, always. If we hadn't had each other to lean on, I don't know how we would have gotten through it all. With 2, then 3, then 4 kids in the house, there wasn't very much time to think about the hows and the whys of what made our relationship or our business tick. It seemed like everything just kept moving along. Thank goodness we had built our life on a strong foundation. I think it was more than just the foundation of our own relationship, though. Part of what made Chip and I work so well together was clearly buried down deep in our roots. It came from our families and our upbringings and the challenges we'd already tackled within ourselves before we even met. I've already mentioned that my early years were spent in Wichita, Kansas, and that's where I was born in 1978, the middle of 3 girls. Teresa, the oldest, and Mary Kay, who I call Mikey, the youngest, are still my closest friends today. But the roots I'm talking about really go back somewhere in the DNA of my parents, 2 completely unique people who met and fell in love back in 1969. My dad was drafted to serve in Vietnam that year when nearly all of the men who were drafted were sent straight to combat, but not my dad. He was held back in his class because of a case of shingles and ended up being sent to Seoul, Korea, 6 months later than originally planned. During Dad's first few months overseas, while at a party with his friends, he met my mom for the first time. Though she was taking English classes at the time, she wasn't able to speak much just yet. But she was fascinated by the American culture, which she'd been exposed to from watching American movies. It seemed to her that women weren't treated with the kind of respect in Korea that they were in America. She hoped that by learning the language, she'd learn more about the culture as a whole. Interestingly enough, the way my mother tells it, she spotted my dad sitting off by himself in a corner at the party and said to a friend of hers, "That's the man I'm going to marry." Her friends thought she was crazy, but she says she just knew. She wound up hanging around my dad and his friends a lot after that night. As it turned out, one of his good friends really liked her, but she always knew my dad was the one. After a few months, they finally started dating, just before it was time for Dad to fly home. Once he was back in America, the two of them began writing letters back and forth to each other. Whenever a new letter arrived, my dad would take it to the translator to have her words read to him, and she would do the same whenever his letters arrived in Seoul. Everything was going well until my dad sent her an airline ticket and a letter that said, "Will you marry me? Come to America." Then my mother got a case of cold feet. It was what she'd always dreamed about, but it was a life-changing decision for her to make, and she had to make it fast. Of course, ultimately, she came and joined him in America, and he went to the Los Angeles airport to pick her up. They were married by a justice of the peace in Las Vegas in 1972, and then went on to live in Wichita, Kansas, my dad's hometown. My dad had been raised Catholic, and my mom had been raised Buddhist Korean, so neither set of parents approved of the marriage in the beginning. From what they've told me, they actually had a rocky marriage for several years. My dad experimented with drugs, as many did back in the 70s, and this behavior was an issue between them. Communicating with one another over a cultural and language divide was surely a challenge as well. There were times, they say, when they didn't think they would make it because all they did was fight. It wasn't until my father lost his grandmother shortly before I was born that he had an awakening of sorts. He was at her house after she'd passed away and was having a pretty bad trip. He envisioned himself in a casket with his family surrounding him, and it hit him just how wrongly he was living his life. He knew he didn't want to end up in the casket the way he envisioned, leaving my mom alone to fend for herself. So he ran out of his grandmother's house and pleaded to God, "If you let me live, I promise I will turn my life around." Through this promise, my parents discovered a faith in God from which there was no turning back. The two of them began memorizing scripture together every day. This practice helped them discover new wisdom, and their marriage found itself on solid footing for the first time and continued from that point forward. My dad's father, my grandfather, had worked three jobs to support his big family of kids. By watching him, my dad had picked up a strong work ethic that kicked fully into gear right around the time I was born. That's when he went to work for Firestone, and every promotion after that meant moving our whole family to a new town. By the time we got to Waco, Dad owned his own Firestone dealership, which was a dream come true for him. By that point, my family had lived in 7 or 8 different houses, from Wichita to Corpus Christi, Texas, to Round Rock, just outside of Austin, Texas. Each one of those moves was a family decision. He sat us all down and discussed it every time, and each time we kind of knew it was coming. We were always sad to leave those places that had become home for us, but we were also always happy for Dad and his pursuit of bigger and better opportunities. Moving was never easy for me, though. This was due in part to my own insecurities, which trace back to my experience in first or second grade back in Rose Hill, Kansas, when kids started noticing that I didn't look exactly like they did. As a small child, I had never noticed there was anything different about me. I thought I looked like everybody else. And really, most people don't look at me and automatically think I'm half Korean. But in those first couple years in elementary school, kids started picking on me because of it. The worst of it came in the lunchroom. I would get served the same broccoli and cheese rice that everyone else in the lunchroom line was served, but a group of boys, especially this one redheaded boy, would start saying things like, "Oh, look at that little Asian girl eating rice." Going to the lunchroom caused me so much anxiety that I asked my mom to start packing me a cold lunch instead. The kids who ate cold lunch gathered in a separate room where it wound up being just me and a handful of other girls. I thought I was in the clear then, until my grandmother came to live with us for a while and started attending school events. She looked like a traditional grandmother from South Korea. It was her first time in the United States, she wore no makeup, and all the children seemed to notice how different she looked from the average Kansas grandma. This seemed to give that group of boys more reason to make fun of me. As a child, I didn't know how to process all this. I just felt the pain of being different, and I felt like I had to be something else in order to be accepted. Luckily, kids grow out of that unfiltered phase, and the torment soon just sort of went away. The rest of my elementary school and middle school years were pretty normal. They were fun. Getting picked on for being different wasn't an issue I consciously carried with me as I grew. It wasn't something I worried about. I always made friends, and for years, that old fear of walking into the cafeteria stayed buried somewhere deep in my subconscious. Moving every few years left me feeling like I could never get comfortable, though. Just when I started to settle in somewhere and find my footing, I'd wake up, and it would be time to move again. I learned to just accept it. I trained myself to get used to it, and I suppose that set me up for my life with Chip in a big way. We may not have been making cross-country moves in our marriage, but moving from house to house is still a big change, and we would make a lot of those transitions. I think the toughest move of all for me as a kid was between Corpus Christi and Round Rock, Texas. It happened during my sophomore year of high school. I'd gone to a private school most of my life, so I was used to having maybe 30 people in my class. When I moved to Round Rock High School, there was nearly 600 kids in my class. This came as a complete culture shock to me. We also moved in the middle of the year, and that made it even tougher, especially on the first day. I had always made friends easily on my first day of school, but when you're the new girl at a private school, everyone's excited to see a new face. But being the new girl at a large public school in Texas was very different. I swear no one even noticed me. I wondered if they even noticed that I was new. For all they knew, I could have been there for years and just blended in. I walked into the lunchroom on that first day at Round Rock High, and every bad feeling I had felt as a second grader came flooding back. I was literally crippled by it. In my mind, I saw myself in a spotlight, a little girl walking into that crowd of people who would surely look at me as different. I was sure they were going to make fun of me. In reality, I don't even think anyone noticed me, but I still felt awful. I walked through that cafeteria without making eye contact with anybody, went straight into the bathroom, and hid in the stall. I stayed in there for 30 minutes right up until I heard the bell ring. I wound up doing that every day for the rest of the semester, from January through May. I spent lunchtime either hiding in the bathroom or ducking into a quiet corner of the library. I'm not sure why I was so terrified. Maybe it was just teenage hormones, but I never even gave those kids a chance to ask me to sit with them. I felt their rejection and acted on it before I ever even gave them a chance. At some point, my mom realized I wasn't eating lunch. She got mad at me at first, and then she said, "I'm going to pick you up. You have to eat." Sophomores weren't allowed to leave campus at lunchtime, so I had to sneak off campus to jump into my mom's getaway car. Once or twice a week, we'd plan it so she'd be there at 11:15 on the dot. I would bolt out and jump over the rope at the edge of the lawn. My mom would have the car door open waiting for me, and we'd take off. She'd take me to Wendy's and then secretly drop me back at school before the start of the next period. And each time she'd say, "Joe, listen, we can't keep doing this. You've got to make friends." Mom wasn't enabling my fearful behavior. It was simply her motherly instinct. She wanted her teenage daughter to eat. As a mother now myself, I can't blame her. And now, looking back, those lunches stand out as some of my favorite times with my mother. We were kind of like lunchtime bandits, stealing away for 20 minutes together to laugh and talk and grab a burger together. Over the course of the summer, I did make a few friends, and by the start of the next school year, it all sort of worked itself out. It took me a good 6 months of awkwardness to finally find a friend group through gymnastics, and then we up and moved again in the middle of my junior year. I arrived at my small private school in Waco in a class of 28 people on the same day a group of Chinese exchange students were visiting the school. Everyone mistakenly thought I was one of them, a Chinese girl who just happened to dress American and didn't have an accent. Everyone was kind of intrigued by that, and it served as an icebreaker that gained me some friendships from the get-go. Right after we moved to Waco was when I started working with my dad at the Firestone dealership and started to get involved both at school and church. It wasn't until my senior year, though, that I first started to think consciously about what it meant to be half Korean. I remember thinking, "I'm either white, Korean, or both, but I've got to own this. It's me." I started to see how beautiful my mom's culture was and how beautiful she was, and there were times when I wanted people to know she was different and she was unique. I didn't want to be embarrassed about that. To my surprise, in the fall of my senior year, I was actually elected as our high school's homecoming queen. I remember walking out on the football field to be crowned, thinking how radically different this feeling was from the rejection I'd felt just 2 years prior, hiding in the bathroom stalls at lunchtime. I was thankful my high school career had ended on a good note. I felt there was redemption in my heart from an old wound that had never truly healed. A few years later, I graduated from Baylor University as a communication major, traveled to New York, and finally got rid of the second grade chip on my shoulder. After all those years of failing to understand or embrace what an honor it was to be part of my mom's amazing culture, I finally believed it was actually a beautiful thing to be unique and to be different. And this, of course, was right around the time when Mr. Different and Unique himself, Chip Gaines, walked into my life.
9. Chipping in. As I mentioned earlier, my mom and dad grew up in Archer City, Texas, a town maybe 2,000 people. When compared to Archer City, Waco had been like the big city, where you'd come to see a movie on the weekend or something. My parents weren't ashamed to tell anybody that their whole group of friends in that town were all poor growing up. But my dad was the poorest kid of the bunch. He lived in what would be the equivalent of the projects in that town, and the government paid a portion of the rent for the apartment where he grew up. His mom, my grandmother, was a single mom raising 2 kids back in the day in a town where everybody was broke. They were known as the poor family. So to my dad, my mom seemed like a rich girl because her dad was a rancher and they had a house and some cows. The two of them started dating in the 8th grade and their small town romance never let up. In those days, in that town, just a few folks had gone to college. No one's mom had gone to college. Nobody even thought about college, really. And even if they wanted to go, nobody could have afforded it. College wasn't really even an option. My dad would probably have graduated high school and become a mechanic or something like that. But then he started playing football, and he was good at it. He received a football scholarship to the University of New Mexico, and the whole world opened up to him. He went off to Albuquerque, and to his small-town mind, it was as big of a change as moving to Las Vegas, or New York might be to somebody. I mean, to him, it was just the coolest place in the world. He got himself out of Texas for the first time ever and started learning about who he really was. The school was in the Western Athletic Conference, which played Hawaii, so he got to go to Hawaii twice. Before that, he had never even been on a plane. My mom stayed in Texas and wound up going to a nearby college called Midwestern State. She and Dad carried on a long-distance relationship for 2 years. Then she transferred to UNM so they could be closer together. The football star and the cheerleader. The polar opposite to Joe's parents in many ways. When my dad stayed on as a fifth-year senior, they got married, and my older sister Shannon came along shortly thereafter. My dad was so excited and motivated by sports and athletics that, after he graduated, he opened up a sporting goods store there in Albuquerque, the city where I was born in 1974. My parents tell me that even back then, I had a way of making friends with just about everybody, and I always wanted to do things for others. I was always asking my mom for money to give to this homeless person that we passed on the streets. And whenever some kid would come knocking on the door trying to sell something, I'd say yes before they even started their pitch, then go running to the back of the house to try to find the money. "Why do you need $5, Chip?" my parents would ask. "Because I already bought this thing. This kid needs the money. Please." For some reason, as a kid, I didn't qualify people like most folks do. I treated everybody the same. From a young age, I understood the true meaning of the golden rule. I literally treated others the way I wanted to be treated. Probably comes as a surprise to no one that I had a certain wild streak as a kid. I had this great friend named Devin who lived directly across the street from me in this cookie-cutter suburban neighborhood. Our driveway sloped down toward the street, and the two of us would ride our big wheels down those hills and shoot directly across the road into each other's driveways, most of the time without even looking. Every other day, someone would slam on the brakes and come to a squealing halt to avoid hitting us. Then some mom would come knocking on our door and always shout at my parents, "He didn't even look. He just scooted out and I almost hit him." We never stopped doing it, though. We just kept zipping across, back and forth, pulling the emergency brake and spinning into a stop right into each other's mailbox. Listen, if the Dukes of Hazzard were doing it, we attempted it on those big wheels. There was nothing terribly difficult about my childhood, certainly nothing like Joe felt when she walked into that school cafeteria. I always joked that my name was Chip, and look, that was tough enough. But other than that, I was this athletic kid with friends, and I thought I had a pretty good life. My only problem, if you want to call it a problem, is that I just never fit society's mold, especially at school. I always was talking at inappropriate times. I was always getting in trouble with teachers who said I didn't do things right. I certainly wasn't writing right. I wasn't staying inside the lines. There was always some structure that I just somehow couldn't fit my little brain into. That probably doesn't come as any surprise to anybody who knows me either. I never thought of my dad as an entrepreneur per se. I thought of him more of a businessman. And yet I seemed to pick up the entrepreneurial spirit from somewhere early on. I remember having my mom drive me around these tennis courts where I'd sell juice boxes to kids in summer camp. I obviously wasn't getting rich off this little business, but it was fun. You know, it taught me a little bit about business and money and work. My parents did teach me the value of a dollar and of hard work. We were always working together as a family, out in the yard or inside the house. That was the beginning of a thought that became a full-fledged goal after I graduated from college. I told myself that I was going to live the rest of my life as if it were Saturday. I told that to Joe early on, and she was a bit put off by that. At one point, she said to me, "Chip, life isn't like that. Life isn't always Saturday." I realized I needed to clarify what that phrase meant to me, so I suppose I ought to clarify it here, too. When I was growing up, Saturdays weren't always easy for us. In our house, you didn't sleep in till noon and then go out to the beach. We would wake up at 7:30 on Saturday mornings and go pull weeds until about 11. Once we were all sweating our brains out, then out came the lemonade, or here come the popsicles. Then it was usually back to work, cleaning the house, cleaning our rooms, maybe helping Dad with some project. But when the evening came, we would pack up the car and we'd go out for a real treat. And a real treat to us back then meant maybe McDonald's for dinner. Now, if it were a big treat, Mom and Dad would take us camping for the night, or maybe we'd go to a movie once in a while. Whatever it was fun. And that's what Saturday came to mean to me. For us, Saturdays weren't about work. They weren't about going to an office somewhere or to school and having the whole family separated for the whole day. Saturdays were less structured. They were about getting the work done so you could go jump in the pool or have an ice cream cone. There was something about school that just didn't work for me. Something about the fact that you had to turn in these assignments and you had to be there exactly when they said or else there was some disciplinary effort. Even before I went to college, I vividly remember thinking, I'm going to put up with this as long as I have to, but the second I don't have to put up with this anymore, I'm out. And I'm going to live every day for the rest of my life as if it's Saturday. There would be times in the coming years when I would be flat broke and think, maybe I messed up. I feel more like I'm living every day as if it's Monday. But that feeling would never last long. Whenever I've been down financially, I've just picked myself back up and worked a little bit harder. And whether it was a little luck or God or a combination, everything seemed to find a way of working itself out eventually. One thing my dad would always preach to us when it came to money was, I'll provide your needs, but you'll have to take care of your wants. So once I was old enough, if I told my parents I wanted some new toy or gadget, they'd say, well, great, there's this lawn two doors down that we keep driving past, and we noticed that it really needs mowed. What if you went and knocked on the guy's door and asked him if you could mow it? How much money is this thing that you're looking for? Well, it's $12, I'd say. Okay, well, if you offered to mow it for $5, it would only take you 2 or 3 weeks and you could have it. They would never say no or say quit asking. They'd just say, if you want the thing, here's an idea as to how to go earn it. There were times when I chose to be the lazy kid and wouldn't bother. And there were other times when I decided I really wanted the thing, so I'd grab the lawnmower and I'd head down the street knocking on doors. When I was in the third grade, my parents moved us to Dallas. Dad sold his sporting goods business and wound up landing a good job with American Airlines. It was a real corporate kind of job, but my dad still managed to put his family first. He'd be home around 5:30 every single night, and right after dinner, he'd be out in the driveway shooting hoops with my sister, who was a basketball player. Sometimes they'd play until 9 or 10 o'clock at night. When I got a little older, I really took to baseball, and Dad did the same thing with me. Every night and every weekend, he'd be out there pitching balls to me, teaching me how to field grounders. The thing is, I started to get good at it. Dad got a bit of a gleam in his eye, thinking I might be some kind of a star player. I loved seeing him get so excited about it, and that made me try even harder. For my dad, achieving goals was basically a mathematical equation. If you hit 100 balls a day, and you work out this many hours, this many times a week, then this is what's going to happen. You win state championships. I followed his advice, and lo and behold, A plus B really did equal C for me. If I did this, then I achieved that. I started to become a star player that he had envisioned. I received all sorts of accolades, and everybody thought I was the greatest thing ever. In some ways, it was easy. It was just this mathematical thing. It would help me keep on a straight and narrow path as I got into high school, too. When a buddy was going off to a party, I could easily walk away saying, man, I'd love to go and have a few beers, but I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, I've got to take a couple hundred ground balls, and if I don't take a couple hundred ground balls, I don't make the state tournament, and then I don't get a scholarship to go play baseball in college. Being a star athlete in high school sort of automatically buys you a lot of friends and attention. I was always the guy who had the funny stories to tell. So when I walked into the cafeteria at Grapevine High School, everybody was calling my name to come over and sit at their table and eat with them. I just led a charmed life. But somehow, instead of taking that and just running with it like some kids do, I never let go of that spirit I had when I was little. That desire to lift people up along with me and help them out if I could. I made friends with the kid who had Down syndrome, grabbing him to come play football with us on Saturday afternoon. One of my friends was an Asian boy who'd been adopted from Vietnam. I just always loved getting to know different people, all kinds, even if they weren't athletes or in the popular crowd. Some of these friends of mine lived in the neighborhood I did, so naturally we all became close. It was easy to make friends with the kids who lived close by, but I didn't forget about them in the cafeteria or in the hallway just because things were different at school. It was just never like that for me. I didn't like being put in a certain box. I didn't appreciate people doing that to my friends either. Being a popular guy in school actually had its downsides. Sometimes I just wanted a day off. I felt a lot of pressure to show up to friends' parties, and people were let down when I didn't make it, or even if I left the party earlier. It was actually a lot to live up to.
He's not a bragger, so he won't say these things if I don't speak up here, but Chip was the football captain at the same time he was playing scholarship-worthy baseball in high school. He was also voted most likely to succeed, most likely to be the next president. Whatever you think a charmed life kid would have, he had it.
I did. That's true. The pressure of being Mr. Perfect and All-American or the most liked or the most well-dressed was a lot to take, especially since my grades weren't very good. I became sort of addicted to the applause and the praise, even from my parents. I just felt awful any time I let anybody down. Honestly, when I didn't play so well in a game, and I saw the disappointment in my dad's face, it was hard. He had such high hopes for me, and I wanted to live up to him. In some ways, I was a lot like the Zach Morris character in that teen series Saved by the Bell. I was that guy, and our school was that wholesome in a lot of ways, too. When we got in trouble, it was for TPing the vice principal's house or something. It was all, come on, guys, let's win a state championship together. Or, come on, boys, let's do the right thing. There were nearly 700 people in my graduating class, but there was very little in terms of drugs, at least as far as I was aware. There was plenty of alcohol around, but I was scared to death of getting caught, so I pretty much steered clear. I seemed to have this innate ability to do the right thing and somehow make it look cool simultaneously. Then I wound up playing baseball at North Lake Junior College, and going to that school was a complete culture shock. A lot of the kids who went to that school came from very different backgrounds and seemed to have a very different worldview. I was used to being around disciplined athletes who dedicated themselves to being the best they could be on and off the field. But at North Lake, some of the best athletes on the team were the rowdiest dudes. Athletes who were much better than I was were doing all sorts of things they shouldn't have been doing at these parties we went to. Interestingly enough, girls hung around that team almost like groupies, and I hadn't expected that kind of thing at a junior college. It was eye-opening. I felt like I was this innocent Leave It to Beaver character from the 1950s, watching this wild spectacle from the sidelines. I went on dates with pretty girls, I hung out at parties, but I just never got into the whole scene. I never really fit in. This was a weird position to be in after feeling like I was the king at Grapevine High School. I did manage to make some friends with a couple of guys who were a lot like me, and those friendships helped me get through the first year, but my heart just wasn't there. I got this little notebook and started journaling, writing songs, sketching out business plans. I'd spend hours in my apartment writing down my thoughts and ideas in that thing. I'd never done that before, but this was strangely therapeutic. I wish I could actually find that notebook. I would love for Joe to see that thing since it's so fitting for her personality. That was the only season in my entire life I ever tried to do any of those artsy-type things. I was just trying to express something that needed to come out. Maybe it was my way of dealing with some loneliness. I wanted out of that junior college, and luckily enough, a recruiter from Baylor University happened to be in the stands when I made one of the greatest plays of my entire career. I was playing second base, and I made this diving grab on a shot between first and second base. Then somehow I twisted around as I slid through the dirt to make this monster throw and get the runner out at first. That recruiter offered to get me into Baylor University and to make sure I would have a spot in the athletic dorm. I honestly couldn't even tell you if they covered my books because I didn't care. I took it. I was ready to leave North Lake and take a fresh start. As it turned out, I loved Baylor. I loved being around all those rich kids, even if I was nothing like them. I loved the girls. I loved the campus. I wasn't a very good student, and I struggled to pass every single semester. But I did fall in love with the city of Waco and started to see myself in that pretty little town forever, especially once I started mowing lawns. It's funny, here I was, at this prestigious school, playing baseball and studying business. But instead of daydreaming about major leagues or running some Fortune 500 company, I found myself in class looking out the window at these guys mowing grass and wishing I could trade places with them. My junior year at Baylor, I decided that was exactly what I was going to do. I wasn't going to quit school. I would stay and finish my degree in business. But I wanted to go out and make real money, like I did as a kid, and not just in the summertime. The way I did with the book company and the fireworks stand. I wanted to work while I was going to school, to get outdoors, to start my own business maybe. And I knew I was going to have to give something up if I wanted to go find the time to do that. Turned out, the thing I needed to give up gave up on me first. A new coach came to Baylor and decided he wanted to make some major changes, so I was gone, along with a bunch of other guys who were on a partial scholarship. And just like that, everything changed. My dad was all fired up about me transferring to another school or finding another scholarship, and a few of my baseball buddies would go on to do just that and have great success. But I wasn't interested in chasing baseball all over the country. I had already seen the writing on the wall. I was a good baseball player, but I wasn't good enough to turn this into a full-time career. It just wasn't meant to be. It was time for me to move on. I dreaded telling my dad, though. He had spent all those years throwing those balls to me for hours and hours every day. He'd come to every single one of my games, going all the way back to when I was just a little kid. And when I grew older, he'd acted almost as an agent or a manager when it comes time to talking to schools or considering my future in the sport. He was so proud of me, and knowing I was going to let him down was pretty hard for me. I put off that conversation for as long as I could, just worrying and worrying myself to death over how he was going to react. When I finally told him, I had tears in my eyes. But my dad looked at me and said, "Son, I love you. And if you're telling me baseball's out, then that's okay by me." It was this beautiful conversation. He was concerned about what I was going to focus on, and I was too. My whole life had been about baseball. And when he asked me what I wanted to do, I told him, "I have no idea." I told him I wanted to go out, maybe earn some money, possibly start a business. And all he said to me was whatever I did, he hoped I was dedicated to it as I'd been to baseball. He wanted me to go out and hit the proverbial 100 balls a day and to give it all I had no matter what I was doing. I just remember vividly for the first time in my life, really knowing in my heart of hearts, that my dad loved me no matter what I was doing. It wasn't tied to baseball. It wasn't tied to something I did or didn't do. It was just this awesome feeling to realize that. And to this day, that is one of the best conversations I've ever had with my old man. I think I learned another lesson that day too. Sometimes worrying about something is much worse than the actual thing you're worrying about. So really, what's the point in worrying?
10. Flipping out. By the time Chip and I met, he'd managed to combine these two conflicting sides of himself. The kid who steered clear of trouble and did the right thing, and the kid who rode his big wheel full speed into the street without looking both ways. I had never met anyone like him. It's funny to me to think that the whole opposites attract thing might have been programmed into my DNA. Just as my outgoing mother was drawn to my quiet dad, I was a shy girl drawn to the super outgoing Chip Gaines. And the fact that he owned a successful lawn and irrigation business and had made up his mind that he loved Waco and wanted to stay put was somehow a perfect fit with everything I knew I wanted myself.
Joe didn't even realize that the lawn and irrigation business I was running when we had met was actually the third version of that business that I had launched. I'd managed to start each of these lawn businesses from scratch, built the clientele, and then I'd sell it, lock, stock, and barrel, meaning clientele, equipment, employees, to somebody else. And that was on top of getting into the business of buying and selling rental properties, plus a little corner wash and fold business that I'd started. I'd almost forgot to mention that. It all began when I tracked down the former owner of the lawn service that took care of Baylor University's landscaping. Remember when I'd look out the window and wish that I could trade places with the guys mowing the grass? Well, that guy worked for this man, and his name was David. And when I asked him for a job, he didn't even think twice. He looked me right in the eye and said, "No." David was this real interesting guy who lived in a loft apartment he'd built inside the lawn company in his warehouse. You'd never guess by looking at him, but I swear he was worth $1 million. I chatted him up the way I chatted lots of folks up, and I wouldn't take no for an answer. I wanted to get a job cutting grass, to learn the trade from the inside out. So I asked him, "How'd you get your start?" He said, "I don't know. I quit school in the 7th grade and just started mowing grass." I kept asking questions, and he kept answering them. Turns out, he was really, really smart, and he basically became a mentor to me. I grew to call him Uncle David, and it's almost like I was sitting at his feet, and as if he were some old guy whittling on a stick on the front porch, teaching me these million-dollar life lessons. So I was getting the academic side at Baylor and learning common sense from one of the most common-sense guys on the planet. It was a perfect education for me. Oh, and he finally hired me. I was persistent, if nothing else. And I grew to love that man, even though he was really hard on me. He wasn't a real encouraging guy by nature. As a matter of fact, he used to joke to all of his buddies that hiring me was like losing two of his best guys. But I didn't mind. I always had thick skin and a positive self-image, so it took a lot to shake me. But one day, after having worked a few months under Uncle David, I was on campus mowing with his guys, and I saw a fraternity soccer game going on at the intramural field a few blocks over. Well, like a dog after a squirrel, off I went to watch, leaving my weed eater right then and there. Time got away from me, and it got dark before I knew it. My heart dropped when I got back to find my guys all gone and no sign of the weed eater. That weed eater cost what I made in a month, so I knew I was in big trouble. I hitched a ride back to the shop, and with my tail between my legs, I told him what had happened. He was upset, but more in a I trusted you kind of way. You know, like when your parents tell you that they're disappointed rather than yelling at you. Sometimes it's just worse. David made it clear that if I ever did something like that again, I was gone, and I promised I wouldn't. Right then and there, I grew up a little. I realized having fun was one thing, but jacking around on someone else's dime and being flat-out disrespectful was a complete other issue. I promised myself I'd never disrespect someone in that way again. I must have done all right after that, because Uncle David and I rocked and rolled together for a whole year without a single hitch. Then one day he said to me, "Son, you're smart. You're going to Baylor University. What are you doing working for me? Go start your own business. You've already seen what to do. Go do it." He sent me to an equipment company in town, and I priced everything out, and the total for what I needed to get started